It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
This is the Fox News Rundown. Extra. I'm Dave Anthony. Today, a look back at something that shocked all of us when it happened 25 years ago. And it's just as chilling now when you hear from a survivor detailing how it all went down back on this day, April 20, 1999, when two seniors at Columbine High School in Jefferson County, Colorado, carried out their plot and attacked their school. Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris hoped to kill hundreds of students and adults, but their bombs did not cause the carnage they wanted. Their guns, though, that's a different story. They aimed at a lot of their classmates, shooting and killing 12 students and a teacher, injuring 24 others until, after battling with police, the two killers killed themselves, ending the rampage about 45 minutes later. Craig Scott was a sophomore in school that day, and he survived. His sister Rachel did not. We talked to him the other day, and he had a whole lot to say, recalling what happened and how he's recovered and taken the horror of Columbine and turned it into a mission to help teenagers in schools today with their mental health through his organization at craigscott.org. Now, our conversation was far too long to include in our regular Rundown podcast on Wednesday, with today being 25 years since the Columbine Massacre. We wanted you to be able to hear the entire interview. We, of course, host two of these extras every weekend, so please subscribe. There's something new to listen to every day. So we thank you for being here, and we hope you come back for more. And now Craig Scott on the Fox News Rundown Extra.
Joining us on the Fox News Rundown is Craig Scott. He is a Columbine survivor. He was there the day of the massacre, which is 25 years ago, April 20, 1999, in Colorado. His sister, Rachel, was one of the 12 students murdered that day. There was a teacher also killed by the two shooters who were seniors, Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris, who were also killed, but they shot themselves to end their rampage on that day 25 years ago. As we look back, Craig now is an advocate for teen mental health and resiliency. He goes and speaks to schools across the country as an organization at craigscott.org. And Craig, first of all, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So it's got to be hard to believe now. 25 years have gone by since this horrible time in your life that has helped define your life.
Yeah, it is. It's hard to believe 25 years ago is when Columbine happened. And it was the worst day of my life, but it's also been the event that's led to the most purpose in my life. And I've seen a lot of incredible good come out from that day. And most people don't, you know, when they think about Columbine, they're just going to think about the lost life, the tragedy, the shooting, but they don't know that some amazingly good things have come out of it that I've been able to be a part of. But I just try to use my backstory to affect change today with what's happening in the lives of teens. But it's I've been thinking about this anniversary for all year long, honestly, Dave. I've been thinking, you know, what have I learned? What's the most important things that I could share? My story is my life completely changed because of Columbine.
Well, certainly. I mean, everybody affected by it had that same situation as you. You, though, you were there. You witnessed it. Your sister was the first victim. Take us back. What happened?
So that day, my sister and I were riding in the on our way to school. We got into a little argument. I kept making us late. And we pulled up to the front, and I got out, and I slammed the car door shut on her and walked into school. I had no idea that would be the last time I would spend with her.
Yeah.
Classes, and then to the library to study for a test. Right before I stepped outside, it was a beautiful spring day, April 20th, 1999. And I remember it was just really like serene. And then I went up to the library and studying for a test with my buddy Matt, this biology test that we had. I was a sophomore. And these popping noises, I thought maybe some seniors were pulling a prank and had brought some firecrackers to school. Mm-hmm. And this was the first mass school shooting that had happened of its kind in our country. And so, you know, it was a shooting. I thought maybe some seniors were pulling a prank. And then this, shortly after, this teacher ran into the room. She was very frantic and she was screaming at all of us to hide and get underneath tables and desks. So I got underneath the table with my friend Matt. My friend Isaiah walked by looking for a place to sit. He sat next to me. And we started hearing these popping noises getting louder and louder. I realized this was not a game or a prank. This was serious. And as they were throwing pipe bombs that they had built in the hallway before coming into the room that we were on, we were hearing explosions. The library was the most intense scene of the Columbine shooting.
Yeah, because they came in right after you heard all that in the hallway. They come in and they just go and target people.
Correct. So they basically we were all sitting underneath tables, and they just treated it like it was a game. They were very into a lot into production. They were very dramatic. They had made a video before the shooting of them wearing trench coats. They didn't normally wear trench coats to school, but they were wearing trench coats. They just treated it like it was a game. They had no respect for life. The first person they shot was a boy named Kyle who had a disability, killed Kyle. They went around the room and they would make fun of or taunt students. They'd peek underneath the table and say peekaboo and shoot a girl. They would,
it's unbelievable.
Yeah, they really
they were having a good time.
Well, there's a movie that they watched over 100 times. I won't say it because it's a bad movie. Mm-hmm. But it really had it didn't make them do what they did. But they kind of took on the persona of these actors in this movie, and they. But it's just one of many very negative influences that they chose. And one of the things that I talk about to teens is about choosing positive influences in your life. What you place attention on, you give power to. Because these guys, on a daily basis, leading up, especially Eric, who was kind of the lead between the two, he had this sick fantasy, this dark, he wanted to be famous. He wanted to show the world his anger. He blamed the world for his own thoughts and feelings instead of having any responsibility or taking any control of his own thinking, even though he had a lot of good things in his life. And, you know, there's a real false narrative that was painted after Columbine that even the psychologists and all of us know as a community. And the false narrative is that these two guys were pushed to the edge because they were bullied at school. And that's not the case at all.
They were never bullied?
You know, bullying was a minor factor
into
why it happened. And
they just wanted to do this.
Eric, he was the kind that if you did anything to him, he would take it to the most grievous level in his mind. And he saw the worst in things. He opened up his journal and the first words are, "I hate the world." And he talks about how he lies a lot. He bought into lies. He bought into this dark fantasy of him being in total power and control. And so were there times that they were treated bad in their life? Sure. Just like every other person that ever lives. We all at times are put down, but was it to this ridiculous, you know, very, very bad extent? No, not at all.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Tell me about, obviously, it's later. They had left the library and they ended up killing themselves, ending the rampage. Police had arrived and all that. But you helped save a life that day. Am I right?
Well, they came around. They saw my friend Isaiah. They called him racial slurs. They tried to drag him out from underneath the table, and they shot and killed Isaiah, and then they shot and killed my buddy Matt, and then I was underneath that table, and I thought I was going to die, and felt like my heart was going to stop beating, and the only thing I could do was to pray. And shortly after they came over to where I was, they left the library, leaving in under 10 minutes, 10 students dead or dying, and over a dozen wounded. And they left, and that's where you see security footage of them walking down into the cafeteria. But I was underneath that table, and I asked God to take away the fear I was having because it was too much for me to handle. And in that moment, I felt my fear was immediately relieved, and I could think, and I mo could move. And I was the first student to stand up, and I yelled at everyone, "Let's get out of here. I think they're gone." And I turned to help a girl who had been shot and help her up. And we ran out, the group of us, through an emergency exit. And thankfully, there was a police car outside in the field. And we all ran for our lives to get behind that police car. And I was so thankful when we got behind that police car just to be alive. The shooters then came back and they began to exchange gunfire with the police. And so if we had stayed in there, because they returned to the library, and more of us could have been hurt. So I'm so thankful that I listened to that voice. And I didn't know what to call it at the time, but I immediately felt survivor's guilt because I felt bad about leaving my friends underneath that table. And
That is
so,
so hard for anybody to imagine that moment, because we've all been to high school, you know. We've all can't imagine that right in front of our eyes.
no,
What you
we're fine.
never imagined could possibly happen is happening right in front of you.
Well, we're more resilient than we realize. When things happen, we have automatic responses that kick in. First of all, when we go into shock and we become numb, that's our brain protecting us from stuff that we can't quite process of what's happening. And, for the next year of my life, I felt like I was in a lot of shock. But just to kind of wrap up what happened with that day, I was then behind the police car. I was with a girl. I was holding her. She was losing blood. And again, this like things kick in that you didn't know. And all I knew was, oh, you're not supposed to let someone who's bleeding out, like, go to sleep. So I was keeping her awake, and I was just telling her, "You're going to be okay." Her name was Val Schnur. And just minutes earlier, they had targeted her, one of the shooters, because they walked by her and she said, "Oh God." And it caught one of the shooter's attention. He said, "God, you believe in God?" And she started begging for her life. And he kept asking and being, and he kept saying, "Do you believe in God? Do you believe in God?" And she kept, begging for her life. And then finally she said that she did. And then I heard a gunshot. It was shotgun. And she had a number of buckshot that went into her. But she survived. And I was holding her. She had made it out of the library, and I was holding her behind this police car. And then other police cars and the ambulances began to come by and pick us up. And right before I left, a friend tapped me on the shoulder and said, "I think there's a girl that's been shot over there." And I look out from behind the police car tire, and I didn't know it at the time, but I was looking at my sister's body.
Oh my God.
She had been killed just right outside the school library. And I'm very thankful, actually, David, that I didn't realize it was her, because I would have lost it. And then another police car came and picked us up and took us to a nearby street. And first thing I did is I started praying for kids with other kids. We joined hands. News was showing up. You can see some of the footage. Kids were being laid on people's lawns. Neighbors were coming out to help. People were passing around their landline phones, because cell phones weren't a big thing at that time. And I got on the phone, called my mom. The first words out of my mouth, I wasn't even thinking. They somehow came out. I said, "Mom, I'm okay, but I think there's something wrong with Rachel." And I went home. I was in a state of shock. I had blood all over my clothes, and my family was really concerned about me, had no idea what I went through, but were mostly concerned about Rachel. Where's Rachel? And I had a feeling, even as I got home, early on, it was just this spiritual premonition that Rachel wasn't coming home. And so I began, it was weird, but you're in shock. So I began to clean the house because I wanted the house to be nice for my mom. I knew it would take it really hard. And then we didn't find out till the next morning. The police called and my mom came down to tell me the news. And I put my hands on her shoulders. I said, "Mom, I'm going to be okay. God's going to take care of me." And so my faith has played a huge role in my being able to heal and feeling like even early on, I felt like there was that God was going to use this in a powerful way, use my sister's story. And sure enough, 25 years later, my sister's story is the number one story told in person in public schools in our country. And millions of kids hear about her every year. In live audiences, we've reached over 35 million. There's been books written, a movie made, documentaries, and I'm working on something early in development on stuff concerning a show. She's just, her story, and if people want, they can check it out, but her story is very powerful.
And you have an organization, your family does, that for years, Rachel's Challenge.
Right.
You also have turned this horrible event into advocacy. You go to different schools. You have a CraigScott.org organization. What do you tell teenagers?
Well, the biggest thing that I deal with is trying to make the school a more connected place. And I tell them my story. I tell them my sister's story. And my sister's story is she only lived to be 17, but she believed that she could have an impact on the world. And she also felt, had a prophetic sense that her life would be short. She told my sister, my cousin, some of her friend, my other sister, that she had this feeling that she wasn't going to have a long life, but that God was going to use her to impact millions. And we see it in her journals, this feeling that, and her middle name was Joy. She was a very joyful person. She lighted up the room, but she stepped out of her way for a lot of people in compassion to do little acts of kindness. And she was into writing, into drama. And we share her story. We share things that she did at her funeral, over a few thousand people showed up, and CNN reported to our family that they had the largest viewing audience in CNN history for her funeral. More people watched her funeral than on CNN than Princess Diana's funeral.
That is something else. Wow.
And at her funeral, we heard just friend after friend talking about, just moments that she took out, that things that she did, little acts of kindness. There was a boy who had a disability who was getting left out a lot. And one day he was going to kind of get made fun of. And Rachel stepped in and stood up for him. And he said that after that day, every day in the hallway, she would say hi to him. And he was kind of socially awkward. Rachel was pretty. And, you know, for a pretty girl to step out of her way, say hi. And he said she didn't know it, but at the time he was having thoughts of taking his own life and felt like he didn't matter. And so what I have to tell the students, one of my biggest messages is this, is that your value is not based on what other people think about you. It's not based on what you can do for others. It's not based on what you look like. You have an inherent built-in value that's there since you were born. It's an incredible, amazing value. And it's not an egotistical thing to believe that about yourself or an arrogant thing, because it's true of other people as well. Now, our value to this world and to others is based on what we do, is based on our offer and our character and how we live our life. But we always have this incredible capacity within to do good things. And so I have even the kids read a mantra, again, because one of the biggest issues in schools is not school shootings. It's depression and isolation and disconnection. And so that's where I'm more focused when I go into schools. And so how do you combat that with the exact opposite things of connection, bringing people together, realizing that you are feeling this way, but your thoughts, you can learn how to take control of your thoughts and take your thoughts captive. And all emotion is just your thoughts manifesting into your body. You just have, you think so much and dwell so much on something that eventually you feel it. You think of something sad and you feel sad. You think of something of an injustice and you feel angry. And so these are some of the messages. And I also talk about how you can neurologically translate certain negative emotions, like anger. If you're carrying around a lot of anger, it's going to come out somehow, sometimes in a destructive way, something you regret. You hurt someone, hurt yourself. But if you take that same emotion and you focus your anger on a goal, that anger becomes determination. And the same thing that happens to you physiologically, like you grit your teeth and you clench your fists and you tighten up when you're angry, that's the same thing as when you're determined. Same thing physiologically happens to your body. When you're anxious or you're nervous, that's actually the same thing that happens to you physiologically when you're excited. Your shortness of breath, peripheral vision, you're shaking, your heartbeat goes up. The difference is your frame of mind. Are you focused on all the bad that can happen, or are you focused on the good?
Now, so, obviously, as you bring that message up and you talk to the kids, since Columbine, we've had a lot of school shootings across the country, many, many of them, certainly some that have even had more death than what happened in Colorado, like in Newtown, Connecticut, or in Uvalde, Texas. Why do you think this keeps happening?
Well, I think that it's at the heart of it, it is not a gun control and it's not a bullying issue. Those can be important issues, and people, I'm not an extreme either way on gun control, but that's the circular conversation that it keeps coming back to, that if we just have enough legislation around these things, it won't happen. But laws don't change people's hearts. What has to change more so is, it's first of all, it's a spiritual and then a mental health thing. It's a heart thing with students. Because if somebody wants to take the time to plan and do harm and take a life, they can find a way to do it. What we have to more address is what's happening within the hearts and minds of young people and what kind of culture. And in that aspect, all of us have a part to play. And that's why when I share my sister's story, I say, look, my sister did little things. My sister did something that prevented someone taking their life. And it was a simple stepping out in compassion. You never know how far a little kindness can go. One of the things that my sister wrote is she wrote an essay a month before she was killed. At the same time that she wrote this essay, the shooters at Columbine were making a videotape in their parents' basement, which I'll touch on here in a second. But in the paper, she titles it My Ethics, My Codes of Life. And in it, she talks about if she were her best kind of person, what kind of values she would live by. So she talked about looking for the good in life. She talked about being a leader, which is leadership is all about influence and serving others. And she talked about showing mercy, forgiveness to people who had wronged her. And then she said this, she said, I have this theory that if one person will go out of their way to show compassion, then it will start a chain reaction of the same. And people will never know how far a little bit of kindness can go. And then she ends her essay by saying, you just may start a chain reaction. At the same time that she wrote that essay, the shooters were making this videotape, talking about their plans and what they wanted to do. And near the end of the video, one of them picked up a sawed-off shotgun that he used to kill Isaiah with, points it at the camera, and says, we need to kickstart an effing revolution. We need to get a chain reaction going here. And he ends the video.
Wow.
The same two words, chain reaction. Rachel was talking about a chain reaction of kindness, compassion. They were talking about a chain reaction of anger and hatred. One of their goals, David, was actually to start a chain reaction of school shootings. And guess what? They did. There's been some copycat. They've been a negative role model. I've met kids that have idolized the shooters. I've become aware of a lot of these school shootings and where they have idolized. But my sister's chain reaction is far outreached, has reached millions and millions more. And that, see, I was angry for years, for the next couple of years after what I went through, because I would also see them come on the news and I would hear, you know, the everyone wants to know why. Why did this happen? And the blame game starts to come up. Mm-hmm. And listen, all of these are important issues. Bullying, medication, gun control, parenting, school culture, all of these are important things. But the main ones to blame, the one to blame are the people that do things with the intent to harm and kill others. And that's what they had. It wasn't their parents that know they were planning on doing it. It wasn't the guns are, it's not the gun. The gun is a tool to deliver it. They had bombs that if they had gone off would have killed 500 students that day. And then we would be looking at how to, so I'm all for things that can help be a part of the solution. But it's not the main culprit. The main culprit is what was happening in their spirit and in their minds. And even as a country, you know, we were number one in the world in education for nearly 200 years. Every teacher, my dad is a scholar in American history and specialized in American education. And one of the things he's taught me is shown me that every educator for 200 years, the philosophy of our educational system was first to teach the heart of students. Every teacher knew the three H's. And when we were the number one first world nation in education, every teacher knew the three H's: teach the heart, then the head, and then the hands. Teach the heart, inspire with moral stories, with ethical stories, of values, of principles, of character, integrity. They had over 300 words of character values that they wanted to ingrain into the youth of America. And because of that, the academic achievement and knowledge was far superior. Horace Mann, who educators know is considered the founding father of American public education. And he said, however loftily the intellect of man may have been gifted, however skillfully it may be trained, if it be not guided by a sense of justice, a love of mankind, a devotion to duty, its possessor of that knowledge is only a more dangerous person as they are, or only a more splendid person as they are a dangerous barbarian. And so he gave a warning, the founding father, that if we take away the teachings of character and heart and values and these principles out of our educational system, out of the textbooks, which we have done, and now you have just kind of like we bring in these side programs, but it's not the heart of what we do. Now we've made knowledge, academic achievement, the primary focus of our educational system. And yet we are nowhere near where we used to be as a first world nation. And so it's, you know, when you talk to any great educator and they will first talk about how they try to make it relational with their students, and that's how they have the biggest impact.
I want to talk about the blame part, Craig.
Yeah.
We just had sentencing in Michigan for James and Jennifer Crumbly. Their son, Ethan, is in prison for life. He went on a killing spree at Oxford High in 2021. Four students were murdered that day. He pleaded guilty. His parents were convicted, separate trials, of involuntary manslaughter for not doing enough to treat his mental health. And James Crumbly, days before the killing, after his son begged him, went out and bought a gun. And that was the gun that was used in the shooting at the school. So they've gotten 10 to 15 years in prison. What do you think of the first parents held criminally responsible for their son's school shooting?
Well, first, I got to speak in that community in Oxford, and they're a wonderful community. And I went after the shooting happened. They invited me to come and speak, and I felt to just be a person that brought some hope into the situation and even a little bit of joy, because I knew the amount of heaviness and sorrow that they were going through. And I had a really wonderful time and met with a number of students that heard and witnessed things and people related to the victims, and I honored the victims. And but I would say that I think this is a dangerous and wrong precedent. We can only blame people for doing things on purpose. And so the case that they're making against the parents is, first of all, they're pinning it on two things. Their main things is that the dad bought a gun.
Right. Which he did and it was only days before the shooting.
Yeah, the dad bought a gun. But in no way did their parents have the intent or the desire for their son or ever encourage. Now, if they had any kind of intent or pushing their son towards anything violent, then by all means, the prosecution should go after them to the full extent of the law. But that was not their intent. And Ethan, their son, was also lying to them about a number of things. But we can only blame people for doing things on purpose. The prosecution is an effort to blame the parents for the murders.
Ethan's 15. You think he was adult enough to make up his mind that he was going to commit this crime, and that's the only responsibility.
Well, we're all responsible. There's a difference between responsibility and then
criminally, and who, I would say.
Yeah, and then who holds the ultimate blame. And so I would say that, of course, the biggest influence that we have are our parents that influence and affect us. But we have teachers, we have the school, we have our friends. And so if you are talking about responsibility and who did not help this young man to get all the help that he needed to become wholesome and well and whole, well, then you can hold a lot of people responsible and you can go start going down a very dangerous track. But to your point, do you remember being 15 years old, and could your parents or anybody make you think or feel a certain way? Ethan Crumbly, who did the shooting, did know it was wrong. And they're saying, well, he has mental health issues. I meet hundreds of kids at schools all the country, on a weekly or monthly basis that have, quote, health, mental health problems. Mental health is, suicide is the second leading cause of death amongst teenagers in our country. The number one is car accidents. So the second piece that they're basing this off of is a picture of a gun that he drew and with a wounded man. And they're saying, well, they're saying they even have a counseling session with him, with their school counselor, and their parents were involved. And they're saying, well, it's your fault this happened because you didn't pull him out of school. And yet Ethan told his parents, that's just because of a video game I'm playing. And and he had written something about feeling useless, like his life didn't matter. So the dangerous thing is, again, there's a difference between blame and responsibility. The prosecution can make an argument that the parents were responsible for the child's mental health, but you could make the same argument for the counselors, teachers, peers. The whole village is responsible for a child's mental health. You certainly wouldn't blame the village for the murders. You would have serious conversations about each of our own responsibility to do our part in preventing these tragedies. Tragedies like this teach us all to be more responsible. This is done through conversations and education, but shifting the blame from the child to the parents or anyone else in the village is not justice. It's patently unjust, the blame lie with my case with Columbine. There were warning signs, but hindsight is 20/20. You look back and you can say, oh, you should have done this, you should have done that. But no one had intent.
Did you meet Dylan and Eric's parents?
I've never met them, but my mom, actually, she has become friends with Dylan Klebold's mom. Dylan would have probably never done the shooting if it weren't for Eric. Dylan was more depressed, and he felt like he had no value. He felt, this is what I run across to almost at every school I go to when I speak. I have kids. I have a book in a two-year time period, David, a two-year time period, people that took the time to get on the website for my family's organization, Rachel's Challenge, and after sharing the story, said that they had thoughts of taking their own life, 10,000 emails in 2 years from kids thinking about taking their own life that had a change of heart. So, to say, oh, you're having these dark thoughts, and to jump from that to, oh, you're going to do a school shooting. So what happened is he got his dad's handgun, he hid it in his bag, and he killed four people. And so to give this parents 10 to 15 years because of that, I think this should be appealed. I think it's a not a just sentence. I even watched as the father, he's hearing and he's just shaking his head. I even watched the judge as she gave, and there's a bit of trepidation in her voice as she's giving it. You know, because I wonder if she's has doubt. Of course, it's a complicated issue, but you know, people need to be held. You know, only to the people to blame are people who do things on purpose and have that intent in their heart for it to happen. And so, as she was giving the sense, I kept thinking, we're guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. You know what the. That's how our legal system is set up. Is there reasonable doubt that they are? I mean, are they guilty of are they the cause of this shooting happening? No, they are not the cause. The boy choosing to do this, and he knew it was wrong. And he, oh, by the way, he wanted to be famous, just like the shooters at Columbine, just like a lot of these shooters that I learn about. They have this deep desire. They want attention. They want to feel powerful. They want to feel in control. It's very arrogant. It's very selfish. It's very, and are they dealing, are they off? Do I also feel for them? Yeah. I have compassion for hurting kids and empathetic. That's what my sister's message is all about. And that's, but I can't not teach these kids that, oh, you are not responsible for your thinking, which then leads to your feelings, which leads to your actions, which leads to your character and habits and the legacy you leave behind.
Craig, obviously, with what happened, it might make parents and, you know, with what happened with the convictions in Michigan with the parents, maybe it's going to make people a little more aware of what is going on with their child, if their child is having issues at the school or depression. What do you recommend parents do if they fear that their child has depression, mental health issues, and could go down a dark path? What do you recommend?
Well, first of all, I would recommend stepping out and talking and letting your son or daughter know how much you love them. And how that, you know, and ask them, you know, what is it that I can do to help you? Ask them, ask the kid, what are you struggling with right now? And, you know, allow them.
But what if they don't have that kind of relationship? What if the child doesn't want to talk to mom and dad?
Yeah. And they can't force, no one can force you to have, you know, but you can make that attempt. And you can say things. And here's the thing is that we all know as we grow up, your parents say things to you that at the time you might not seem like are registering. And guess what? It sinks in and it becomes a part of who they are. Later on, they go, yep, mom and dad were right. Yep, I should have listened. And so don't stop saying the right things. Don't stop saying your truth to them. And speak encouragement into them. Take intentional moments to just say, you know, I know things aren't, I know this is a, whatever your life circumstances with your children, take time to be intentional. Tell them that you love them. Tell them that they matter. Tell them that they're valuable. And, you know, that's speaking life and encouragement. Everybody needs that in their life. Everybody needs encouragement. And so these kids that are getting off into, this dark place, they get this wrong idea. Well, you know, how I'm going to matter now is I'm going to do something. And here's another thing that's happening with youth today is that social media is a huge influence in our world today. There's a thing called the seven mountains of influence. And I would call social media the eight mountains of influence. And it's a big deal and it's impacting kids. And what I've seen a change in kids over the years is I've seen them become a little bit more robotic, a little bit more, and not everyone. This is just a general statement about our culture and kids across the country. But I've seen them not pick up on social cues, not be able, because all of their communication is happening through a device. And so the programs that are, quote, connecting us more, in some ways are creating more disconnection because nothing can replace in-person relationship. I mean, letters, comments, And basing your self-worth, what's happening with social media is, you know, everyone wants to be liked. And have people like you. And especially when you're at school, you're, you know, there's a lot of kids, you want to be win with the cool crowd. You want to be liked. You want to be popular. That's a big thing for a lot of kids. Now you got to be liked by millions of people. You've got to have thousands of likes to matter. And that's what I also teach about social media and talking to kids about, you know, doing digital detox. And so that's a whole nother issue of getting your self-worth from and self-value from, again, the opinions of others and how many likes. And so what's happening is I speak in elementary schools with the program. It has nothing to do with the shooting. It's all focused on kindness, compassion, choosing positive influences. And I'll ask the question sometimes to little kids, what do you dream of becoming one day? You know what the number one answer that I hear is and have for at least 7 years?
Well, if I'm thinking back to what I was at that age, either a garbage man or a fireman.
Well, you would be way off from what I hear today. Although every once in a while, something like that comes on, a police officer.
I thought the garbage truck was so cool, I have to admit.
Yeah, yeah. But today, the number one answer that I get is, I want to be a YouTube influencer. I want to be famous. I want to be an influencer. I want to be famous.
Wow.
So they're seeing that, you know, anybody can have their own platform. Anybody can have their own distribution because of social media today. So now it's about how many followers you're getting, how many likes, how many people like you. And so that is becoming such a big thing. Kids are growing up with an average of six to eight hours of screen time every day. Where's the time in-person relation? Where's the time out in nature? We know we need this. So that's another reason that we're seeing some of these kids, they're saying, well, how am I going to get famous? Oh, I'm going to do this. And what they don't realize, what Ethan doesn't realize when he spends the rest of his life or most of his life in prison, is that little fantasy that he played out will not at all be what he thought it was. And he'll learn the very hard lesson of how this it's took away from his life, his parents' life, and literally the lives of people. And he'll deal with the inner turmoil that comes with that. And I do hope. I mean, that's the point of prison. Is the prison is not just for people to go and suffer and it's for them hopefully to change too. And I do hope for this young 15-year-old, you know, I've met kids that have planned to do shootings. I had someone hand me a hit list at after school assembly and say, you just saved a lot of kids from dying at this school. Our program has stopped documented school shootings and thousands of suicides. And so I hope that for his sake that he has, that he changes but he's going to go through a lot of very, very hard times. And because of what he did, ultimately it's him to blame for his actions.
Well, what happened 25 years ago, those two killers do not have that. They died that same day. It's been 25 years since the Columbine attack in Colorado, April 20, 1999. Craig Scott, a survivor, lost his sister that day and many other friends and loved ones, but has turned that into a life of helping people as an advocate for teen mental health and resiliency. His information you can find at craigscott.org. And Craig, we're sorry for your loss all these years later. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, David.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.